This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. And just in time for Father's Day, get $5 off the limited edition Father's Day set by entering the code PEL when you check out.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 140 is something like, how can existentialism support ethics? Or maybe, what is the human condition? We read Simone de Beauvoir's The Ethics of Ambiguity from 1948, parts 1 and 2. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lintzenmeyer, a thing crushed by other things in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, adventuring in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allwyn, willing my own freedom in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey in my tragic ambiguity in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Why, there are some ground rules for our discussions that we haven't read in a while. The first one being, try not to assume that our audience has read what we're talking about or has any other background in philosophy. The second one, don't make arguments that hinge on something other than what we've agreed to read. Don't say, you'd know what I was talking about if you'd just heard Tim Quirk's Naturist Manifesto, The Otter Song. You guys are going to have to YouTube that to see why I would give him shit about The Otter Song, because you should. Number three, we will be rigorous and exact in all that we say, unless doing otherwise would be potentially more entertaining. Simone, long requested, long on our list, partially got held up because we had a guest that was lined up to do it for some years and kept pushing us off, and then finally said she just didn't have time anytime soon. So we're braving it guestless. And after getting into the book, we decided that it was awesome enough and it was dense enough, and we wanted to read the whole thing, even though it's a pretty short book. So we're going to have a 2-discussion episode run. So that's 4 episodes for the non-citizen folk.
Well, it's 2 episodes still technically, right? 4
books. Yes, it is 4 installments. Give us some reactions. What do you think? How do you want to kick this off?
I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, I would agree.
It's dense, but it's very readable. I thought that she goes right at something that we regularly run into in a serious way, which is confronting, well, what do you do about making an argument for how you ought to do anything in ethics in the face of something like existentialism, or what would it mean to justify a notion of freedom that's rooted in the self? It'd be related to how you would justify our own, well, I guess relativism in some respect. What you would mean by saying, you know, understanding that our values are relativistic doesn't mean that they are unfounded. It was very, very interesting.
Yeah, I think she makes an attempt to answer some questions that were levied at, like, Sartre and some of the other existentialists about a positive existential ethics that goes beyond dealing with absurdity or creating your own meaning, but also has what I think are some pretty robust critiques of traditional metaphysics, ethics built on traditional metaphysics that I'm excited to get into.
So should we say what we mean by existentialism? And what she means by existence, a word that she uses a lot.
Well, I figure we'll get into it for sure.
Well, let's place her. This is 1947. She is the longtime companion of Jean-Paul Sartre.
He's her longtime companion.
Yes. According to Wikipedia, this was actually prompted by a lecture she gave in 1945, after which she claimed it was impossible to base an ethical system on her partner Jean-Paul Sartre's major philosophical work, Being in Nothingness. So Being in Nothingness came out in 1943, not that far before this. However, the following year, over a 6-month period, she took up the challenge, publishing the resulting text first as installments, and then in November 1947 as a book. So this is something that took a little while to come together and was explicitly a piece of apologetics for Sartre's existentialism. When this was recommended to me a long time ago, I'm not sure by who, that this is a clearer explanation of existentialism than you'll get anywhere from Sartre. His Existentialism is a Humanism essay that we covered is 1946, written at the exact same time that this was. what we got out of that, and folks can look at our old episode from that, was, okay, well, yes, we're absolutely free, but somehow willing your own freedom, embracing your own freedom, requires acknowledging, even willing, the freedom of other people. So that claim is in there, but there was nothing like a coherent argument for why that would be the case. And it just seemed kind of strange. And so existentialism has come up in our episodes many times. You know, we had that one on No Country for Old Men on Cormac McCarthy's book, where it looked like there was an existentialist villain in there in that discussion. And almost every other discussion we've had on this topic, it's been, well, if you create your own values and there are no values written in the universe, then what really prevents you from just being a bastard, as long as you're consistent about it, as long as you're not self-deceiving about it? It seems like there's nothing in existentialism that would prevent that. And especially if you take a doctrine like Camus, where the ethic is sort of preserve the absurd, recognize that the life force that is driving you, that gets you to come up with goals and pursue goals, is kind of silly, given that we're all going to die and that we all know that we're all going to die. And so that's, for him, it was what characterizes existentialism, is keeping the absurd in mind. Now, for Sartre, it was keeping your freedom in mind. And Simone de Beauvoir, this notion of ambiguity, though, is not in either of those folks. I think it comes close to what Sartre was getting at, obviously, but it's her own formulation, and it's a pretty ingenious one.
Well, it's her way of putting this conflict between what we might typically think of as a conflict between free will and determinism, the fact that we are, in some sense, part of nature and we are material beings and we obey the laws of physics and chemistry. And then the question is, how can we freely choose anything under those circumstances? So the ambiguity here is just, which is the way she starts the book, is just this, the fact that we are both subject and object, and the fact that we feel like we are both product of external circumstances and that we are free. And the way existentialists talk about external circumstances is, I think, less in terms of, you know, what we think of as physics, but more in terms of character. So that's something that comes up in Sartre and will come up here, the extent to which we are determined as essences. So this is to call back to the something we explained during the Sartre episode. Existentialist credo is that existence precedes essence, and that's a way of formulating the idea that we are not determined by some essential nature. We create ourselves and our values in some sense.
And it's amazing how free of that kind of language this book is.
I mean, free of what?
Talking about existence and essence.
Well, there's a lot of existence. There's no
and
essence.
A lot of being.
Yeah. Yeah. She's really using the word being a lot instead of, or in itself.
And that we are a negative, which is something straight out of Sartre too. It's kind of glossed over. Should we try to explain that? I understood when we talked about Sartre by saying that nothingness is a strongly present element in our experience that is usually denied by philosophers, but that if we're going to give a good account of the phenomenology, the kind of example that we gave for that was, you know, if I'm looking for my friend Pierre in the cafe, I actually perceive, if he's not there, the absence of Pierre. I perceive the nothingness. You know, so pretty much whenever there's human meaning, whatever is human expectation, then there's a lack of something.
Well, also, nothingness is a way of referring, for Sartre, to consciousness. It's a way
So that's what she's using here.
But in this case, she's actually drawing a lot on Hegel. So negativity is just this sense in which we have desires and needs. That's what creates the whole possibility of even having ends, right? Ends are these things we reach out for to satisfy that negativity. We start with this privation, and then we try to compensate for that in some way. And that makes us beings who reach out into the world. So that's the negativity part. We've got something that needs to be filled up, or does it need to be filled up? That's really the question, because the filling up is sort of the path we're tempted to go down. But I think she's going to say that's a bad path.
Shall we go to the text?
Yeah, I think she walks through this whole thing in a very clear, stepwise fashion. And the part that you were talking about is like the second or third step. Which is fine.
It's really not till page 10 that she starts to talk about
this. That's exactly right. Page 10.
Yeah. This is the first paragraph of the book, page 7 of the version I have. By the way, I've got the Citadel Press edition. Is that the one you guys have?
Okay. I have the Philosophical Library Open Road edition.
The continuous work of our life, says Montaigne, is to build death. Man knows and thinks this tragic ambivalence which the animal and the plant merely undergo. A new paradox is thereby introduced into his destiny. Rational animal, or thinking reed, he escapes from his natural condition without, however, freeing himself from it. He is still a part of this world of which he is a consciousness. He asserts himself as a pure internality against which no external power can take hold, and he also experiences himself as a thing crushed by the dark weight of other things. At every moment, he can grasp the non-temporal truth of his existence. But between the past which no longer is and the future which is not yet, this moment when he exists is nothing. This privilege, which he alone possesses, of being a sovereign and unique subject amidst a universe of objects, is what he shares with all of his fellow men. In turn, an object for others, he is nothing more than an individual in the collectivity on which he depends.
So you might think that's step-by-step nice explanation. To me, it's throwing a bunch of seemingly disconnected phenomenological stuff at you to try to get at what this fundamental paradox is. Instead of saying, here's what the paradox is, and just stating it, she states it in seven different ways, none of which are exactly the same.
Seven? I got two. What are the seven?
Rational animal, being unto death, pure internality, feeling free against, as opposed to being a thing, an individual in the collectivity. It's even a little unclear what the relation of that last sentence. In turn, an object for others, he's nothing more than an individual in the collectivity on which he depends.
Okay, so I got two notions of that out of this. I think those boil down to two. One is the notion of a transcendent experience or consciousness, which is independent of the physical world. And then I also, and these are connected, is the notion that there's this transcendent moment in time between past and future. So there's a temporal aspect, and then there's what you might call a physically transcendent aspect. And of course, those two things are related, but I thought it all boiled down to those two aspects. And she's talking about what it means to have subjective consciousness embodied, physically embodied.
Isn't there a third one in that last sentence of being an individual within a collective? That is the relation of being a subject, and later on she'll talk about as being a subject and an object.
Yeah, I think it's those last two sentences are a pair. This privilege which he alone possesses of being a sovereign and unique subject amidst a universe of objects, which he shares with fellow men. But on the other hand, he's an object for others, nothing more than an individual in the collectivity on which he depends.
Exactly, a sovereign, free entity and a mere individual within a collective.
So the contrast there is between being a Cartesian cogito, a sort of free-floating subjectivity, and then Hegelian subjectivity, which requires the collectivity, it requires the recognition, the subjectivities of others.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, and that relationship is going to be part of the way in which you have freedom that is constrained and freedom that has a direction, freedom that has demands.
Yes, the roles of others are going to loom. Other freedoms are going to loom large, you know, eventually for them.
Exactly.
The point of this is to say that this tension exists. And as you mentioned earlier, there's this desire to try to reconcile that or to do something about it. And she's going to take a different tact.
That tension that you call, that's the ambiguity.
Yes. She calls it ambiguity.
Yeah. And so in the sense that that tension described in this first paragraph is a kind of statement of the condition of man, that's our ambiguous condition. And in that ambiguous condition, that's why we have this whole book, An Ethics of That Ambiguity. Is how do you have an ethics out of that kind of ambiguous state?
So you might think just from that description that it is the same as what Camus meant by the absurd. And we won't see until later why she thinks that that's objectionable. That saying it's absurd implies something negative. And a lot of the point of the book is that, no, we can actually sort of spin this positive. We can say that recognizing the ambiguity and holding on to it in much the same way that Camus thinks we have to keep the absurd alive in order to sort of be cool, if not virtuous, to be manly in the way Camus sort of talks about it. If we end up fulfilling our existential duty on de Beauvoir's account, we do end up pursuing not just some individual frame of mind that could be characterized by Sisyphus as he is pushing the rock up the hill, or rather following the rock down the hill in hell. That's not the kind of thing that de Beauvoir, she explicitly argues against. Like, maybe there is a correct way to be even in that situation, but that's not what she's considering. That's not what she's interested in. She's interested in this ultimately is going to play out into some political ends. That yes, you actually do have an obligation just based on your very freedom and your relationship to yourself to pursue something that looks quite a bit like traditional ethics and certainly involves a great deal of political activism. So just to jump forward, that's going to be where our stop point is between this whole discussion and the second whole discussion. Is this time we're talking about the existentialist ethic, and the second one we're going to talk about the politics, which we'll get more into sort of what she's famous for. The book she wrote right after this was The Second Sex. So a really, really influential work of feminism. Now, she doesn't get in that specifically, but you can kind of see where she ends up going with this. It addresses a lot of the same kind of stuff we just were addressing in the bell hooks and even previous episodes about our duty to raise people's consciousness and give them freedom and self-actualization.
Well, yeah, really the question of the book is, and I think Dylan and everyone, I think, has probably mentioned this already, but it's really, can we establish any sort of values with any specificity with existentialism? Does it leave us? And this is really around page 8 that she starts asking these questions, whether we can actually specify any values. Because it's one thing to give some sort of general meta-ethical notion, right? And then it's another to say, can you ever really say what I'm supposed to do specifically, concretely, from that? All ethics sort of suffer from that question. And we saw the way Kant tried to get there. And actually, there's a lot of crossover here with Kant. She sort of pivots off it. He tried to get us there from this idea that you could sort of derive ethical maxims purely from the notion of having a free, autonomous will. This is one of his sort of transcendental arguments. They just sort of simply fall out of the idea. Thou shalt not kill essentially falls out of the idea of an autonomous will, because if you violate the autonomy of others, your will ceases to be autonomous and you cease to be moral. And so it's sort of a tight argument like that. So we're trying to see here if we can get the same sort of guidance, same sort of very specific guidance. And especially in light of the fact that existentialism is associated with despair and being ethically impotent and unmoored and even nihilistic, ironically, that's what she's fighting against.
Yeah. And in fact, she'll, as we go on in the book, she'll give a diagnosis of each of those sort of directions of existentialism and how, in fact, they're not actually rooted in existentialism, but misinterpretations of the forms of traditional philosophy.
Yeah. And they really each reflect a moral failure, in fact.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And as long as we're playing the comparison game, you know, we usually consider existentialist ethics as basically, well, what Nietzsche said, except working out the details. And maybe she is not a very charitable reader of Nietzsche, and by extension, probably Sartre wasn't either, but she explicitly criticizes him, and his view is sort of too subjectivist, too just, you know, that the upshot is you only end up caring about yourself. And, you know, certainly, you know, you can see in Nietzsche's dismissal of the mass of people as sort of hopeless and not worthy of his teachings. This is something that she's not going to approve.
Well, see, it's the idea of a will to power where we impose our values on others, ultimately we'll see that we're supposed to respect others as ends in themselves. Does that sound familiar? And respect their values.
Did you notice that her interpretation reminded me of what Eva had said some episodes ago about Nietzsche as basically being a philosopher of tyranny? And that's what Beauvoir's criticism is, essentially.
Hmm.
But as Mark said, you might find as an uncharitable reading, but her criticism of his will to power and nihilism is that it is, like several other versions, it's a path to tyranny, either to being a slave or to being a tyrant. That seemed to be the two options you have.
What if you want to be a tyrant to your own self as a slave? Sorry.
That's pretty Hegelian.
No, I don't want to get us. I could try and defend Nietzsche here, but I think we don't need to try and defend Nietzsche.
We'll pull out the couple quotes when we get to it. Yeah.
If you're playing the tyrant and slave dialectic in your own head, then you're being very Hegelian, was my point.
Well, and she brings up Hegel almost immediately.
Yeah, almost constantly.
So she's sort of another way of sketching out this ambiguity is connecting it to the hierarchy of body and soul. So we've had so many philosophers, this whole phenomenological tradition, and many entirely foreign to that tradition, who are trying to argue in some way that this Cartesian metaphysical or even epistemological take, that there's the realm of the mental and the realm of the physical that are separate. It seems de Beauvoir is going to want to say that preserving the ambiguity actually means accepting that as a phenomenological fact, that yes, consciousness really does seem different than the physical, whether or not brains end up being identical to mental states, or that's all sort of beside the point.
Yeah, trying to reduce one to the other is a way of sort of denying the ambiguity. This is the argument she makes on pages 6 to 7. Traditional philosophers have sort of tried to undo that tension.
Yeah. So. Not only does she not like ones who try to, you know, eliminate the mind or eliminate the body, like Berkeley, you know, say, oh, everything is really just ideas. There's really no body at all. What body is ultimately mental stuff. She even doesn't like people who try to come up with some unifying, you know, neutral thing that really is both of those. So any kind of identity theorist or, you know, Spinozic solution. If you're really doing hard science and you have a purpose into it, you know, there might be a point, but just sort of holding it as a philosophy that will have an effect on the way you treat yourself and other people is entirely wrongheaded.
On my page 7, it's right after her paragraph where she brings up Hegel. She says, at the present time, there still exist many doctrines which choose to leave in the shadow certain troubling aspects of a too complex situation. But their attempt to lie to us is in vain. Cowardice doesn't pay. Those reasonable metaphysics, those consoling ethics with which they would like to entice us, only accentuate the disorder from which we suffer. Men of today seem to feel more acutely than ever the paradox of their condition.
Because of technology.
Yeah.
So how would we characterize, I mean, metaphysically, we've had plenty of examples of people who try to reduce one to the other, but how does that translate into an ethics? I mean, it seems like, for instance, if you say, well, you know, mankind has a teleology. There's something that is naturally good for us. We are animals, and to fulfill that animal goodness is to, well, pursue health. And it turns out, according to Aristotle, that in fact we're social animals. So just it's not just pursuing our own health. It is actually helping other people, at least within some social circle, maybe not universally. Or you could even argue that the, you know, human well-being does require that we not be cruel to anybody, even animals, you know, that we could sort of expand the all this is sort of treating us like physical beings that are in some way determined. It's not saying, well, we might fail. There's still a point in doing ethics. The animals are too dumb to realize their own good is really what that comes down to. But it seems like that whole take on ethics is going to be, it's too deterministic for de Beauvoir, for any existentialist, even though that sounds very much like what I think Nietzsche following Aristotle is arguing. Is this, you know, something that involves consciousness? Certainly it involves us making decisions, but ultimately the justification comes down to something about our nature, our static nature as human beings.
Is your question, how is she founding this ethics in a way? What assumption, what ultimate assumption is she making?
Well, I'm trying to ask, yeah, what is she arguing against? And she's not filling in the details here. She's saying there are these metaphysicians who kind of paper over the mind-body distinctions, and ethicists, you know, the very same people are ethicists that do that. But she's not really giving us what kind of ethics she's talking about that she doesn't like.
Yeah, I don't think she's specifically arguing against other ethics in this.
What are you looking at specifically? Anything in general or just?
The quote that Dylan just read.
Oh, okay.
I mean, she criticizes on those pages the traditional philosophical attempts to deny ambiguity. And that's a sort of stepping stone to saying, hey, we have to face the ambiguity. And I do think a lot flows out of that idea of facing the ambiguity and facing this thing that she calls negativity.
And as Wes referred to just a few more sentences later in characterizing this, she says, the more widespread their mastery of the world, the more they find themselves crushed by uncontrollable forces. Though they are masters of the atomic bomb, yet it is created only to destroy them. I mean, I think Wes is right that in this section, she's criticizing the certainty put forward by something like science or a technological approach to the world. But I think she's basically criticizing any attempt, whether it be for ethics or for understanding our own condition, that doesn't understand its fundamental ambiguity. So that ambiguity will be fundamentally uncertain. I guess those two words kind of go together. And so the more you try to actually ground it, I mean, I take her saying at this section, the more you really try to nail it to the ground, the more you're going to find yourself unable to hold on to it. It's like trying to hold a cup of water with your hands.
What is nailing ambiguity to the ground? It seems like the nailing is just denying it, is denying the transcendence part of it.
Yeah, well, yes. Right. So the more you try to be certain about it, the less it's going to work. Right. That's where our taker is saying the more widespread their mastery of the world, the more they find themselves crushed by uncontrollable forces.
Yeah, so she says later, so let on the same page, let us try to assume our fundamental ambiguity. It is in the knowledge of the genuine conditions of our life that we must draw our strength to live and our reason for acting. So other than this assertion that, you know, there is this ambiguity and we must face it, there's not a whole lot of argument to that effect. And then the rest of the argument depends on that assumption.
What underlies the criticism that she's making is the notion that to have ethics, there has to be a lack. If you believe that people are perfect or wholly contained inside of themselves and completely self-justified, then you don't really have to have ethics. There's no reason for it. And so if you think about a founding metaphor like the fall, the original sin, right, you have to posit that there's this gap between where you are and where you should be. And what she's criticizing these people of collapsing that distinction as they propose it, and then they try to find some way to reconcile it where they erase it. So it's an acknowledgement, and then, but it's simultaneously then a move to erase it. Whether you think there's a gap between perfect being and our sinner selves, or if you posit this radical gap between subjectivity and objects in the world, this, you know, that there's consciousness and mind is matter. Ultimately, what people try to do is get rid of that. Mm-hmm. And I think what she was saying is, it's not about trying, you know, we all accept that there's some kind of gap in existence, regardless of how we characterize it. And without that, we don't have a notion of ethics. So it makes perfect sense. The trick is to just accept it and not try to reconcile it in those ways. Am I reading too much into it?
Yeah, that's very, very well put. This is not new to philosophy. This idea, you know, it's a recapitulation of the idea of embracing our ignorance, for instance, with Socrates, the idea of embracing the ambiguity. And, you know, she mentions Sartre here, where on page 8 again, you know, where man tries to in vain to synthesize the for oneself and the in oneself to become a god, which is sort of reminiscent also of that Aristophanes myth in the Symposium, where that is the original sin. So the original sin is this idea that you can undo this sort of inevitable state of privation, of being at a distance from your object, whether it's just an object of consciousness. It's the idea that you can undo that sense of mediation, or it's the idea that you can have everything you want. You can perfectly satisfy yourself and complete yourself through things in the world and through things that you value, projects. That's a path that's doomed to failure. Ethically, you have to face up to that, and you have to reorient yourself towards your ends, towards your values, to not give them that kind of import.
Hey, let's stop for a second to hear from our sponsors and then hear about what's going on with Not School.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Harry's. Father's Day is coming soon, and what are you planning on getting your father? If you're like me, your dad just gets whatever he wants for himself, and he's very hard to shop for. You have to figure out a way to get him something that he's not expecting or something that he wouldn't get for himself. Fortunately, Harry's has got you covered in this regard. So while supplies last, Harry's is offering a special limited edition shave set for Father's Day. The Father's Day set includes a matte black razor handle and a very cool chrome razor stand, the moisturizing foaming shave gel, handcrafted blade cartridges, and a travel cover, all for $40. It comes in this sleek black giftable box, and you can even add custom engraving and a personalized card. It's perfect, and it gets shipped directly to your dad's door. So as you know, I've been using Harry's, and I love their products. The blades are super sharp, and they provide a really great shave, but it's not just about the blades. I use the face wash in the shower to kind of loosen up the skin and open it up, and then when I shave, I get a nice close shave using their foaming shave gel and then finish off with aftershave, all of which have awesome scents that my wife loves. You know, it's great because you get all of this quality and all these great products, and it's substantially cheaper than you would pay if you went into a store and tried to buy it, and it's shipped right to the door. You know, why would you pay upwards of $30 to $35 for 8 blades when you can get them for half the price at Harry's? I'd like you to go to Harry's right now and redeem a special offer for PEL folks. Harry's is going to give you $5 off your first purchase with promo code PEL. And don't wait, free shipping for Father's Day ends on Friday, June 3rd, so act now. That's H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. Enter code PEL at checkout to get $5 off. And you can get your dad something that he's actually going to like and use and not expect something he probably wouldn't be buying for himself.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. Most of you listening are dedicated to the thoughtful reading of and serious conversation about the greatest books ever written. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the St. John's Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions. The books of the teachers and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well. The Graduate Institute accepts applications on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's College sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long Science Institute programs. So, if you're a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in a serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
Hey guys and gals, Brian Wilson here with an update on the PEL Not School Seminars for June. Summer's here, and obviously all the cool kids, aka PEL Not School members, are getting invites left and right to barbecues and pool parties. Your friends know that nothing gets it started like your ontological, spelled with a K because you're edgy, playlist on Spotify. It's heavy on Prince, so you can use that as a tie-in for Machiavelli deep dives, and French pop star Zaz, whose musical blossoming, you can point out, came about in Bordeaux, just like Montaigne. Speaking of Montaigne, we've got a seminar Sunday, June 5th, led by yours truly, on his Of the Education of Children and Of Cannibals. These two essays are a core part of the Montaigne canon and contain such zingers as Truth and Reason are common to everyone, and no more belong to the man who first spoke them than to the man who says them later. And Clever people observe more things and more curiously, but they interpret them. And to lend weight and conviction to their interpretation, they cannot help altering history a little. Deep stuff.
Thanks, Brian. Looking at the Citizens Forum, there are proposals on the table for groups on film as art and philosophical issues pertaining to Dungeons & Dragons. And there's an active group on the 2016 presidential candidates' policies. So you can go sign on to one of those or propose your own group. Hey, and also don't forget there's going to be an after show on the Simone de Beauvoir episodes. That's on June 26th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time.
To register for any of these seminars or organize your own, you simply have to become a PEL citizen, meaning pay $5 a month, $5 being a crazily low rate to pay for this kind of personal interaction and instruction. And of course, it also includes the full-length, ad-free versions of the entire PEL podcast back catalog. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me at brian@partiallyexaminedlife.com. Hope to see you at a seminar soon.
We should talk about this sentence here, this right after what you just read, Wes. Well, he said, does not Sartre declare in effect that man is a useless passion, that he tries in vain to realize the synthesis of the for oneself and the in oneself to make oneself God? It is true, but it is also true that the most optimistic ethics have all begun by emphasizing the element of failure involved in the condition of man. Without failure, no ethics. For a being who, from the very start, would be an exact coincidence with himself in a perfect plenitude, the notion of having to be would have no meaning. The only thing in that couple of sentences that we haven't just talked about is this being in exact coincidence with himself. This is the most striking, obvious way in which consciousness is supposed to be a nothingness, a negative, is because if we are being, we all want to be being. And later he'll say, kids, in fact, think that they are being. In other words, they think that they have a particular essence. They think, oh, I'm a smart kid, or I'm a scamp, or something. Like they will buy a label that's the actual, that is the example she uses. So that is denying your freedom to think that you are a thing that sort of is programmed. And I was thinking about this in terms of, like, if you shouldn't need the three laws of robotics, because if you program your robot, then it'll just do what it's programmed to do. Like if you, on top of it, have to tell it, hey, despite your programming, which is very complicated and might give you
contradictory things. Here's some overriding things to consciously consider, some rules to pay attention to beyond your program. Like, no, that's a confused, you just haven't programmed your robots very well in the first place. Those should not have to be normative rules. Those should just be built into the programming. The robot should be in coincidence with itself.
The idea is that the programming could be a basis for, not for simply a determined behavior, but for artificial intelligence and free behavior. So that's the, whether or not that's realistic, that's the idea there, in which case you would need to say, hey, yeah, don't hurt people.
This is making me want to go back to a question Mark asked earlier, which was, for other forms of ethics, what would be the force behind them? So if you, as we're acknowledging here, you're all, to have an ethics at all, you have to be wrong in some way. And so is it as simple as, well, the reason that you have an ethics in a case where, you know, you have an absolute good out there is that you're not trying to attain that absolute good. You're denying your own being or something like that. And it still makes me wonder why that even works. If it's an inexorable force that you should go in that direction, that your ethics points in that way, why do you have to exert any effort to do so?
So you mean, are you thinking of virtue ethics and the idea that if we have sort of these ends built into us that some part of us naturally strives for, why does that require any work to
yes.
reach them and to become virtuous, let's say, when virtues are just these things we naturally tend to be?
Yes. And the other one would be, you know, in the case of where we always try to do things that are good, and when we make ethical mistakes, it's because we have a misunderstanding of what is good for us. So we're making an error. And the question there would be, why would we want to be right? Especially if you take away something like salvation, right? The reason you want to be right is that you want to have eternal life under the blessings of God in heaven. If you take that part away.
Well, for happiness, right? For the Greeks.
For happiness. So
being in coincidence with yourself means you are attaining your telos, and, you know, being what you're supposed to be is being happy, right? Isn't that what it means? Even if you don't seem happy.
Well, I think it's not just the case for teleology. Teleology and virtue ethics aren't the only examples of ethics that are contradistinction to the ethics that she's talking about. They all are, right?
Right. She thinks she's just, I think the word was consoling ethical views. So it's the idea that even though there's a lack, and with, you know, the idea of original sin, that's a permanent lack. You're never going to actually attain, maybe when you die and become an angel or something. But as long as you're a human being, you're never going to overcome.
Exactly, when you die and become an angel.
Yeah, and that's the call, right? That's the reason why you would try to overcome it, is so that you can guarantee your eternal life in heaven.
But what's supposed to be consoling about this is just the fact that there is a structure there. There is either a human nature that underlies our biology, you know, in the case of the teleological views, Aristotle and them, or there is a moral law that God has set up. There is a structure.
It's not just that we have
a place.
It's not just that, though, because, you know, what we're trying to do ethically when we define these ends, it's not just that we're trying to do something negative or say what we ought not to do, or we're going to get punished or something like that. We are trying to fill this lack. We are trying to perfect ourselves or complete ourselves in a way. And the idea is that this is, you know, whether or not you think it's directly correlated with happiness, it's the most choice worthy of all things. And it's the thing we ought to pursue with abandon. We ought to find the right values and give everything to them, because whether it's going to make us happy or whether it's going to actualize us or however you want to put it, that's the way to go. And her argument against that is, no, we have to give up the whole project of self-perfection, of becoming ultimately virtuous, or of saying that, hey, I've got the ultimate value now, I'm going to give myself to that, whether it's a cause or something else. We have to completely abandon that, which is not to say we abandon values or projects, but that we have to change our attitude towards them. So it is a radically different approach to values than other ethical systems. You know, and again, it's a way of sort of embracing the lack. Let's put it that way. Feel the burn.
This whole thing is a long, drawn-out way of explaining that existence precedes essence thing, that the essence would be, if you have a view of human being that has a good that a human being should attain, that the virtue for a human being is to pursue this kind of goal, that's exactly what she's denying. We're not born with an essence like that.
yeah, we can all have radically different kinds of values and projects. Although, again, I think, you know, bringing in others and respect for the freedom of others is going to provide a lot of, you know, constraints of the traditional sort that we're used to seeing in ethics. So she's going to rail against tyranny and oppression and all those things that, you know, people typically reject within ethics.
She's
yeah, but if there is an intrinsic direction for her, which is just the notion of freedom, and if there's any virtue that is most characteristic, is our invoking and manifesting our freedom. And in the end, the ethics that she's talking about is the true fulfillment of that freedom, the true actualization of that freedom. And so we're most manifesting our existence in that way. And so there is something in existentialism, as she's describing it, which is the motive force of our humanity. It's maybe not to be godlike or not to be any of these other things, but it is the thing that gives direction. As we go on, we'll find out all the ways in which you can fail to actualize that freedom. And those are all genuine failures of being less than human. In fact, there's being the sub-man and being the no-man and all sorts of things like that. But those are all turning on us not doing the thing that we most ought to do, which is actualize our freedom.
Now, does she feel like our freedom, I mean, of course, the most diehard Christian is going to say, yes, of course we have freedom. That's the whole point. We can choose the right thing or we can choose the wrong thing. But it's always been the existentialist position that real freedom, true freedom, means not only that you can choose between good and evil, but that there is no pre-written good and evil to choose among. That would be somehow an abrogation. That is an abrogation of your freedom to say, I can choose good, I can choose evil, but that doesn't make evil stop being evil or good stop being good. Like, there is a predetermined role that we should follow, and our only freedom is choosing within that.
Yeah.
Are we far enough that I could read something from page 18?
We will want to backtrack, I think, but
oh, okay.
I mean, you should go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I want to take issue a little bit with the way Mark was phrasing it. So page 18, she says, indeed, we are coming to the real situation of the problem. There is an ethics only if there is a problem to solve, and it can be said that the ethics which have given solutions by effacing the fact of the separation of men are not valid precisely because there is this separation. An ethics of ambiguity will be one which will refuse to deny a priori that separate existence can at the same time be bound to each other, that their individual freedoms can forge laws valid for all. So it's not, Mark, technically speaking, that there's some notion of good, or it's the idea that there are universals, that there's a finite way of reconciling, or as she says, effacing the difference, right? Because she talks about the notion of the present and our experience as being finite in our facticity, which is to say in our being in the world, our physical presence in the world is finite, but we experience consciousness as infinite and the future is infinite. And the idea in ethics is that pulling out a rule that a universal law, which is a Kantian strategy, a Christian strategy, a variety of different things to some extent, is trying to efface that difference between finite and infinite, between individual and particular, you know, and universals. And that's where the problem lies. So it's not that,
yeah,
you know, it's not that there aren't values. It's that you try to apply a singular value to everybody in all instances.
Yeah, before where you just read, Seth. So the, you know, Mark was talking about, you know, it's not the case that values are out there in the universe, whether they're dictated by God, or some people seem to think now that they could be scientifically discovered. They're not out there for us to discover. They come from our own will, which of course is not new. You know, Kant and the German idealists thought the same sort of thing. And so she then tries to make a distinction between existentialism and German idealism. So on page 17, she says, for existentialism, it is not, quote, impersonal, universal man who is the source of values, but the plurality of concrete, particular men projecting themselves toward their ends on the basis of situations whose particularity is as radical and reducible as subjectivity itself. So even though she agrees with Kant in the sense that values sort of spring out of the will, out of our wills, for the German idealist, it becomes this sort of universal transcendental will that gives moral laws applicable to all human beings. And here she's talking about something much more particular. You know, she's thinking even in terms of the particular projects and the particular ends we have in our own lives. And of course, my ends are going to differ from yours. Of course, I'm going to be devoting myself to different sorts of things than you are.
Well, to move back in pages a little bit, the first place she talks that I see about sort of the positive take is page 11. It was right after the part that I was just quoting. She's talking about this failure as described in Being in Nothingness, the failure of the human condition, that we're a useless passion, something. Well, man, Sartre tells us, is a being who makes himself a lack of being in order that there might be being. So
yes.
We've talked about the lack. The lack is you make yourself a lack of being. In other words, you transcend. If anybody points at you and say, you are a slave, you are, you know, a specific thing, it's the nature of human consciousness to posit that we are free. You can just decide to not be that today, whatever anybody labels you. That's.
But I also think to make yourself a lack of being, again, is to embrace the desire, embrace the privation. So that's what it means to have ends. Ends are inversely related to privation. The ends are the things we seek because of the privation. So to be free and to freely posit ends is the same thing as to be a lack.
But how would that be any different? It seems like if you're just saying desire is what makes you a lack, then you don't have to have consciousness for that. Animals have desires all the time. So every time my dog is hungry, she's making herself a lack
of being.
Your dog
doesn't start projects. We're talking about specific kinds of desires, you know, in self-conscious beings. So
there's another way to, I think about this, because she does mention being frequently, is the idea that if you think of yourself 100% as being and finite, there's no room for becoming. So there has to be some kind of a lack, or you could say non-being. It's similar to this conversation that we had many moons ago. I think it was in the Heraclitus episode about being and becoming, the idea of change, the notion of the static versus the dynamic. We have no place to go. We have nothing to do if we are what we are 100%, if there's no gap for us to strive towards, if there's no future to project into. So, you know, we have to create this for ourselves. And that's, in fact, what we do. And that's what this notion of subjectivity is.
But I think, Seth, you're making the case that I was just trying to make inadvertently, which is when Heraclitus is talking about that, he's not talking about consciousness. He's talking about all of nature. And if you just determine something having a self-moving power as indicating a lack, well, that's much too global to just cover consciousness.
So in this whole page 11, right, she also uses this phrase passion, and passion is also synonymous. It's also in the same family of these words as negation, desire, privation. And we give ourselves reasons with passion. We give ourselves ends by way of passion. And then she goes on to argue that there are two different ways you can think about this. You could think of the sort of primal passion as wanting to merge with our objects and completely satisfy our needs. That's the quote-unquote wanting to be. When she talks about wanting to be as opposed to wanting to disclose being, wanting to be is wanting that merger, wanting to be not simply this subject in tension with the object, whether you're thinking about consciousness or whether you're thinking about desire. But the more primal passion is actually wanting to disclose being, which means leaving our ends never fully satisfied, being in this kind of tense relationship to the object so that we can be connected to it without us disappearing into each other. That's disclosure. So by uprooting himself from the world, man makes himself present to the world and makes the world present to him. She repeatedly talks about this distance and uprootedness and maintaining this tension as opposed to simply having everything. I think merger is a good word for it.
This helps me make some sense out of the thing that we talked about with Heidegger and then later with Eva Brandt about letting the beings be.
Yeah.
That's sort of the existentialist goal for Heidegger was to let being disclose itself, was to
leave being alone. No, I'm just kidding.
Let it be.
Exactly. Eva Brand's take on it was even more sort of, oh no, even Heidegger was being too forceful and willful about it, that no, we need to really... This is a peaceful thing. But I don't know, it would seem strange. I'm fine putting that forward as a desirable end as part of de Beauvoir's positive solution. But she's saying, Sartre tells us, you know, uniformly across the board, that man is a being who makes himself a lack of being in order that there might be being. So she's not just giving Sartre's view of the existentially correct move. She's saying this is just what human beings are. Whether or not they're
committing all the various atrocities of existentialism, whether they're, you know, end up being subman or these other things that we'll talk about, they all fall into the category of you make yourself a lack, so you have some sort of desire on Wes's take, in order that there might be being, which I guess that phraseology covers both the letting the beings be and also I want to be that being, which is one of the many wrong ways.
Yeah, letting beings be, you know, among those beings are our ends. So in other words, it's like we let ourselves be empty a little bit so that we can have this directedness towards ends, towards the beings of the world.
Yeah.
Because our ends are directed towards beings, you know.
Or toward creating a situation.
Well, to wanting to disclose being. Right where Marx says that, you know, Sartre tells us that man makes himself this lack of being in order that there might be being. The term in order that clearly indicates an intentionality. That's the directionality that Marx was talking about. It is not in vain that man nullifies being. Thanks to him, being is disclosed and he desires this disclosure. There is an original type of attachment to being, which is not the relationship wanting to be, but rather wanting to disclose being.
So the wanting to be is sort of the way we'll see that people fall short all the time. They don't maintain their lack, and they develop, again, the fantasy of absolute ends, or yes, these ultimately satisfying beings outside of them that they can use to complete themselves. Instead of having ends and saying, you know, well, I have an end, I have a project, I really want to do this thing, but it's not the end-all be-all. I don't live or die by this. And later on, we'll see it's because there's a more important end underneath it, which is just willing my own freedom. Sorry to jump ahead a little bit. But in other words, when I manifest freedom, it's not, and I will a certain end to come about. You know, that end is going to pass by. It's going to be gone and I'm going to be on to something new. So it's not the essential thing. And that treating it as essential is disastrous in life. The essential thing is simply that I will my own willing, that I will my own freedom. That's the ultimate end. My own freedom, rather than I'm going to be a rock star or I'm going to be, you know, a really, really good person or things like that.
Yeah.
Well, I like, Wes, that you put it in that way of wanting these things to complete yourself, because this very much describes the Christian picture of, you know, we live in original sin, we are incomplete. And for me to be complete, it's enough that God exists and God has this whole structure that I am a part of, whether or not I sort of realize it or will it or not. And to the extent that I can internalize that supposed fact, that actually will make me feel complete.
Right.
And anybody who doesn't realize that, that's what's going to be lacking in their lives. Don't you feel a sense of emptiness? Don't you need God to fill that hole?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be God. I mean, he mentions at some point, you could take the same attitude towards, say, fashion, when he's talking about the world of the serious. The world of the serious is just any of these.
Yes.
It's really a matter of how you approach it. It could be any sort of content. There's a kind of quasi-religious aspect to any value that you take really, really seriously. So,
and that's, again, a Christian strain of argument, which is to say, if you don't let God fill that God-shaped hole, you're going to have something else fill that hole. It's just inevitable. It's human nature.
Versace.
That we have a lack that we will fill in that way.
Right.
And so better to have it pointed at God than at mammon, at something else.
I sat next to a guy who basically made that argument to me on my whole plane trip.
Right, coming back from Italy?
You mean someone tried to convert you?
No, thank goodness it was not on a 9-hour plane ride.
Someone tried to proselytize to you?
He's one of these examples of just a very friendly, gregarious guy. He's probably about 75 years old. He was very, very talkative, chatting with me. And then eventually, learning a little bit about me, it became clear that he was going to try to save my soul. And in fact, at one point he says, you know, you seem like a really decent guy. I just can't help but feel like you're just missing out on just how great it is to have God in your life and have Jesus as your savior.
See, this is such a perfect example because I've had this happen to me before. I think there's some really friendly people, and what happened? It turned out they were staying at a hotel that I was working room service at, and I sent them a bottle of champagne. And then after all that happens, they're like, we're going to try and convert you now to our religion. I feel dirty and used by that. And so in a sense, it's like that actually is an example of people not respecting your freedom and not treating you as an end in yourself. They're treating you as a means in a sense, even though under some more traditional interpretation of morality, perhaps they are treating you as an end in yourself. They're trying to save you. But under, I think, the existentialist interpretation, and it's the way it feels. And I think it would feel this way even if I were religious. I mean, under the existentialist interpretation, my ends and my moral direction in life is actually something very, very particular. And for someone else to pretend that they can just get in there and tinker with that for the sake of my own good is actually demeaning.
I agree. I also find it, you know, it wasn't the first time that kind of thing had happened to me either. And what I find is strange is the confusion that I don't seem like I'm a complete asshole or I'm like deeply corrupt without having Jesus as my savior, because there was like a kind of astonishment that that wasn't the case. I just find it strange.
So you need to explain to such a person that, you know, there's an original type of attachment to being, which is not the relationship of wanting to be, which is what you're describing, of wanting to be the child of God and sort of have your world filled out already.
Exactly.
But rather wanting to disclose being.
Yes.
Now here there is not failure, but rather success. This end which man proposes to himself by making himself a lack of being is in effect realized by him. By uprooting himself from the world, man makes himself present to the world. It makes the world present to him. There you go.
Or you could say the genuine man will not agree to recognize any foreign absolute. Page 13.
All right. Have we explained this point enough? I'm not sure that this will be convincing to anybody.
What do you mean? Which part?
Why the quote that I just read is an appropriate response to that as opposed to the quote you read. This wanting to disclose being, can we say more about how that plays out as a positive directive that ends up entailing in ethics?
Well, that comes up later in this section, right? Wanting to disclose being is a way of reformulating her quote from Sartre, a being who makes himself a lack of being in order that there might be being. She goes through this step of clarifying that as, look, it's not that we want to be, but it's an activity of wanting to disclose being. And then later on in the paragraph, she says, man makes himself a lack, but he can deny the lack as lack and affirm himself as a positive existence. He then assumes the failure and the condemned action insofar as it is an effort to be, finds its validity insofar as it is a manifestation of existence. And then she gets into this discussion of conversion and what an existentialist conversion would be as opposed to a Stoic conversion or Hegelian conversion.
I want to convince you as well that my talk about desire is not, I'm not simply pulling that out of my ass. So for instance, on page 13, she says, it is desire which creates the desirable and the project which sets up the end.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually is a parallel statement to the idea that we have a lack of being in order to disclose being. You can think about this in different ways, but it's the having the lack in order to disclose being is parallel to allowing desire in order to create the desirable.
Which sounds in isolation, yeah, just like you're stating relativism. In other words, things are desirable because people in fact desire them. Well, can't people desire all sorts of crazy contradictory things?
Well, she's going to address that.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's actually the next section. So she basically, yes, right after that, she asks the question, well, how then can it be objective? And then she's going to try and say how it can be objective.
Right now, she's not even stating the solution to the problem, right? She's characterizing where emotion comes from in human beings. Right before what Wes just read, value is this lacking being of which freedom makes itself a lack. And because the latter makes itself a lack, that value appears. I find myself stumbling over this. I guess this is the nothingness in Sartre where a lack is actually a thing or a being. And what you talked about at the beginning, Mark, where you perceive the missingness of something.
I think this gets cleared up on page 14, mm-hmm, which is right after where Wes was reading before, the first sentence that he already read. The first implication of such an attitude is that the genuine man will not agree to recognize any foreign absolute. And it continues, when a man projects into an ideal heaven that impossible synthesis of the for itself and the in itself that is called God, it is because he wishes the regard of this existing being to change his existence into being. But if he agrees not to be in order to exist genuinely, he will abandon the dream of an inhuman objectivity. He will understand that it is not a matter of being right in the eyes of a God, but being right in his own eyes. Renouncing the thought of seeking the guarantee for his existence outside of himself, he will also refuse to believe in unconditioned values, which would set themselves up athwart his freedom like things. Value is this lacking being of which freedom makes itself a lack. So it's value
which is another way of saying desire, like you were saying, Wes. Value is this lacking being of which freedom makes itself a lack, and it's because this latter makes itself a lack that value appears. So freedom makes itself a lack, therefore value appears. And then the next sentence is the one that you just read, Wes. It is desire which creates a desirable and the project which sets up the end. So does filling in that detail say a little more of why we're not talking about ontology here in terms of is a nothingness a thing? I don't think that's going to be clear from anything that's in this essay at all. And I think that's...
No.
I don't even want to try. We can understand how value is making... Well, yeah, value is this lacking being of freedom, of which freedom makes itself a lack.
You don't have to go down the road of trying to understand that nothingness is a being to just understand that you're using lack as a noun. And you're talking about it as... I want to use the word as a something, right? But... it's holding a place. The lack is holding a place. You're talking about the hole in the donut, right? I mean, whatever it is.
Yes.
Right? You don't have to go all being of nothing on it just to understand. I liked Wes's formulation of it being parallel to a desire. To have a desire is to want to fill in something that you are missing.
Yeah. And the larger thing is that we're getting at a defense of the possibility of an existentialist ethics. And people are disturbed by the fact that when you say values aren't absolute and they're not outside of us. And she's saying, well, actually, really to have a coherent ethics, we have to acknowledge that they come from inside of us, that it's our own lack which ends up positing these. And it really is actually a function of freedom. So instead of being these sort of passive recipients of desire for something or other that is objectively good outside of us, we are free to create the lack in ourselves and to direct ourselves where we will.
Well, this seems like a good place to pause. And next week, we'll get into the question of if values are created by human desire, then why would that result actually in an ethics? Why wouldn't that just result in a lot of people desiring all sorts of crazy, contradictory, self-destructive things and destructive each other? Why does it actually come to an ethics and actually get into what she positively says about that? So tune in next time. A week from now, or since we're about to have the rest of the discussion in about 5 minutes our time, why don't you just listen to it now? Get the citizen version of this. That is an ad-free, unbroken version of the full discussion, just like we used to release in the olden days. Just become a Partially Examined Life citizen. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. Put in your $5 to sign up for the service, and you'll get the ad-free version of every single episode going forward, including ad-free feed that you can just add to your phone, so it's just as convenient as you're getting the podcast right now. All right, so long.
The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.